There she paused for a while, thinking. But the temptation was so great that she could not conquer it.
This is
the Grimcast. Would you hire me, Claire?
I want you to just like do it again. And can you just have fun with it? Just make it your own.
Okay. There she paused for a while thinking, but the temptation was so great that she could not conquer it. That's like flipping it on its head. Like that's like giving them what they didn't expect or didn't want.
Like the temptation to click back to her reels and log back on was so great. I am so happy to get to hang out with you and to discuss this terrifying and horrifying,
creepy and awful and horrible episode. Let me get my coffee and my granola. Let's talk about it.
Bitsy is not here with us today. She is with Superman.
Yeah, you know, I mean, shoot, girl, right? If you had the opportunity to hang with Clark Kent.
Save the world and network television. So we are going to trudge on and she will be popping in from Canada.
We're here to talk about Lonely Hearts.
Nick learns that a series of disappearances, rapes, and possibly murders of beautiful women in the Portland area is connected to a honeymoon hotel where the owner harbors a hypnotic power. And this episode, when I dove not that deep, you know, cursory Google.
Like a top two search.
Like top two search. Yeah. Which is just essentially putting the quote into the search bar. So this is based on Bluebeard, which is a story about this man who has a blue beard and that's why nobody wants to be with him. And there's a family that is trying to marry off their daughters, Bluebeard. And in the story, it says, both girls, however, raised objections and his offer was bandied from one to the other, neither being able to bring herself to accept a man with a blue beard. Another reason for their distaste was the fact that he had already married several wives and no one knew what had become of them. And that's just where this story kicks off. And then you find out that he has several wives. He has cut their necks, sliced their necks, knifed their sliced.
Knifed, sliced, gutted?
Gutted them, almost, yeah.
All horrible options, really.
And they're all in his basement. The heroine of the story is saved. But then the moral, according to this college website, is, ladies, you should never pry. You'll repent it by and by. 'Tis the silliest of sins. Trouble in a trice begins. There are, surely, more's the woe. Lots of things you need not know. Come forswear it now and here. Joy so brief that costs so dear. So, which is essentially saying, hey, women, stay out of your man's cave or else you might find porn or
wow, gosh, we are so supported, women as a gender, just like essentially from the beginning of time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This episode was like a turn in the real ick factor. Like we were kind of, you know, just sort of dancing around some gruesome themes, but this was straight up gross. Like I'm not really a fan of like human sacrifice or like keeping people in cages is really the most horrible thing I could envision upon somebody. The whole thing. Although Patrick Fischler, though, I'm such a fan of his. I have been for a super long time. I just thought he was the best casting.
Yeah.
He's such an interesting looking guy. He's so unusual, but like, he's got like some BDE, in my opinion. You know, like he's got some swag. Like I was like, yeah, I got this. This makes sense.
I mean, his career, it just must be such a joy for him as an actor because he does get to come in and just steal scenes and play just real lovable weirdos.
He's so fun to watch, even the way he ate the frog.
Oh, yeah.
In the garden. Like, he's just really great. He's a really good actor. Those are those actors, you're just so tickled when they come on screen. You just love anything they do.
At the end, too, I had forgotten that he's not dead. The taking in of the EMS worker at the end.
Although I thought the lip licking, teeth licking was like a little much.
Michael Waxman directed this episode. It was like, I'm sure there's like, we need a visual representation, but the shot is really tight. So maybe if you can just, swirl that tongue around.
Oh, God.
Mouth means sex.
Mouth means sex, in case anyone is missing that.
A lot of mouth work. A lot of mouth work in this episode, actually.
There was.
And then in this episode, we also get some backstory for Captain Renard.
Yes. I forgot. He's looking like a damn snack in that one scene.
The blood spatter on his shirt, which...
So good, right? Was that scripted, you think, or you think that's just Sasha being fussy with his clothes?
That's probably Sasha being fussy with his clothes.
That was a storyline I really liked, and I wanted to kind of see more of just the royals and his position within the Vessen world.
Yeah, I mean, they took a long time to let that play out, but these first episodes are really fun because you get to see, or at least for me, be reminded of all of the threads that were either continued or totally abandoned.
Yeah, Nick, can't do everything.
No, do you notice that when Nick knows all about cars or like that blue sports car?
Totally. I caught that.
Where it was like, oh yeah, that was a thread that we just didn't really keep.
Hey man, it's episodic television. You can only do so much.
It is. It's like, let's see what works. Let's see what sticks.
Let's talk about the hysterical comments that were said one, not two, but three times in this script. The 322 friends. Who the hell has 322 friends? It's like the show is 100 years old. Like, sometimes I'm like, oh my God.
It's like, oh my God, that poor person. Does the person know no one?
My grandmother has 322 friends.
Yeah. I mean, referring to Facebook, I guess, but maybe even Friendster. I don't know.
Whoa.
But 322 friends. I want to know, like, what seems like the right amount? Like 286, no, 507 is too much, but 322. Let's pass that by the network and see if that works.
Did you notice on her fake Facebook page, her friends on the corner are all, it was like Tim, like all our PAs. I love that stuff.
And then also that this episode should just be titled, How About We Get the Shopping Done and Go Home and Integrate? And by the way, everybody, Bitsy might be missing because she did not want to get abused by us talking about this grocery store scene.
The integration. Ooh, that's hot, girl. That's integrate. Ew. Because, you know, those are our friends and we know they do integrate in real life. So I was a little bit grossed out.
I don't know, you guys.
Keep it clean. They're like in the organic section.
And it's a good thing that this is an early episode where you don't quite have the balls yet to say, like, I don't want to say that. Like, can we nix this or say something else? Because I can't. Those words cannot come out of my mouth right now. Today, we have Silas Weir Mitchell coming onto the show, the bloop bat in chief himself. Silas.
There you are.
Hi.
How's it going?
Really good. How are you?
Good, good. We were just talking about how lucky everybody is to have you in their presence right now, as usual, as we all were.
Yeah.
Per usual.
Yeah. And there are some really good Monroe moments in this episode, too. So I'm glad you're here to talk about this one.
First of all, talk about that picture behind you.
This is the genealogical tree of humanity from Monera, which would be, you know, single cell organisms, monads, all the way to the gorilla, the orang, and man.
And where is it from?
It's from the spice shop.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was when they built out the spice shop and they created the back room, which became the sort of like Scooby den, when I realized like, oh, I want to move into this set. I would like to live here. If I could live here, my life would be complete.
That was one of the many, many items Silas and I stole off of the set in the last 48 hours.
I think we were gifted these things, weren't we? Weren't we allowed to have these?
We were allowed to have one. I might have taken a few more.
I took a Columbia rain jacket. That was it.
I have a few little things lying around. It's true.
What's in the middle of the tree? So between single-celled organism and orangutan.
Reptiles, amphibia.
Perfect with this episode about eating frogs.
Yes, it's a goat eating frogs. Go figure.
Did you, and Silas, I'm sure you already knew this, but Capra means goat in Italian.
I did not know that.
The character's name. Yes, Billy Capra.
That's brilliant.
Wow.
I absolutely love that kind of stuff. And I did not know that. I love that. Frank Capra was Frank Goat.
Frank Goat. And you knew Jim before? You knew of them, right? Before you were hired.
Yeah, the history of that is that, you know, I don't remember auditions particularly, but I remember this one. And that just goes to show that somehow you know, even though you don't know. You know that this is a moment, even though you don't know, because you don't. You're in the moment, you're in the present, and you're just doing your thing. But the fact that I remember it so well after the fact means that unconsciously in that moment, I knew something was happening, which was going into the Kauf's house to audition for a movie that Jim had written called A Fork in the Road. And it was a typical Kalfian story where it's just complication upon complication upon complication upon complication. Just a snowball of wrong turns, as Jim does. He writes himself into a corner to get himself out. He does the same with his characters. He writes them into corners and forces them to figure their way out. So it was really a very funny script about a guy who gets out of prison because the car that he's in, taking him from one prison to another, hits a fork in the road and the tire blows and he gets out and then he's on the lam. So I went in and I was reading for this character who really should have been sort of like a corn-fed quarterback type. And I was like, all right, you know, sure, I'll go in. What the hell? As we know, what does the breakdown mean anyway?
Yeah.
So I went in and it was Fern Castle or Cassell, and they were sitting in Jim's living room.
I don't think that's allowed anymore to go to somebody's house.
Yeah, no, probably not. Probably not in today's world. So I walk in and I don't know anybody. And they laughed a lot at what I did because I think it was so not... not what was written, you know? It was so kind of wrong that it was right in a way. And so I remember being like, that was really fun. That was a fun audition, you know? And then I got the job. And so that was the beginning of like Jim seeing me in a way that fit his world, even though what he wrote really wasn't me. So he knew me from that. And that was a really fun shoot. We were in Montana, basically on their ranch and the environs.
With Grimm, though, how did that call happen to, like, come into Grimm?
You know what? The only thing I remember from Grimm is what I wore. Not the only thing, but the thing I remember from the first audition, which was at CBS Radford on a rainy day, too many people in one room. I think it was, like, Sean, Todd, David, Jim, Mark Buckland. But all I remember really from that audition is what I wore. It was like a fleecy... It's like the most animal-y thing without being animal-y, you know? It was like this fleecy thing.
The tail seemed a little much, though, when you added that
right.
at the very last minute.
Yeah, right, right. So anyway, I went in once, and they were like, okay, come back. And I was like, this is great, be fun, blah, blah. And then I went in to do the second reading, which was in a studio, remember?
Oh, like testing?
It was the test, but I didn't know that it was the test.
Just you.
Well, no, I think David and Russell were there too. Like other people were there, but—
How did you not even know this was the test?
Because it was like no test. I didn't sign anything before I went in. It wasn't in a conference room.
Oh my God.
Essentially, the role was yours is what we're getting at here. It was just like a formality because the role was always yours.
It was not a formality to me. It was like, oh, now I'm doing this and I'm on tape. Like the studio wasn't there. It was the same people that were in the other room, but we were just in like a theater, a little tiny 20-seat theater with raked seating.
That's brilliant.
And a camera was on, and I did not think this was the test because a test is not just for the camera. A test is like you're in front of 13 or 14 bored suits who would rather not be there.
Oh my God. The worst.
And this was not that. So I did not know it was the test. And then it turned out to be the test. And I remember feeling like I hadn't tested. And I didn't think that I had got the job yet because I hadn't really tested. And my agents kind of screwed with me and were like, well, you haven't tested yet, but you got the job. I was like, wait a minute, what? What do you mean? I was like, you haven't tested, but you got the job. Do I have to test? You know, do I have my testing?
I'm sure being in Jim's position, when it's like, I have the guy, I know exactly who I want. And I'm sure if you guys have been the fall guy at a test where it's clearly not your job, but you can't bring just one person or they'll tell you to go back and find more people.
That's like every audition I have nowadays is that.
they're just like oh slipping your tape in. By the way, this is who I'm hiring. I mean, but that to me, the Monroe character really is Jim's voice. Jim Kauf, and we keep talking about the Kaufs. They're, you know, one of the creators of the show, and he has such a love of history and historical fiction and, you know, obviously fact, but all of just the German and like creating these character names. I mean, that is just so Jim.
It's so Jim, and he's also really into the bad pun, you know?
Hey, guess what? You know who really delivers the bad pun?
Hey, man.
Like an ace?
In the right hand,
right
a bad
here.
Pun is a good joke.
I have to say, honey, like going back, especially these early episodes, where you meet Monroe and you just start to see all the little idiosyncratic elements of the character. You are so good in this role. everyone plays a part in the show, but there is a quality to the Monroe character that really only could have been you. And it just brings the heart, the comedy, the irreverence. There's just such a joyfulness when you come on screen. And it was really fun to like look back at these early episodes. This one in particular, there were so many choice moments of Monroe in this episode.
Yeah, it's like there's not a lot of me, but there's good moments. You know, it's very sweet of you, Bree, to say, I really appreciate you saying that because I do feel like it was a really good fit, you know, and I got the voice. And then Jim was writing his silly stuff like that quote, everything has an ending except for a sausage, which has two.
So stupid. I love it.
Alles hat ein Ende, something diverse, which has zwei. You know, I don't know what the... I literally thought that was a Jim joke, but that is a German saying.
Oh my God.
So there was like Jim and his silliness, and there was a real Venn diagram overlap of Jim, Silas, the character, and the world. And I also think, you know, whenever they talk about the show starting to make sense to them, quote unquote, breaking the story... It was the idea of a good Vesson who could talk to the Grimm and not get killed by him and not kill him.
Mm-hmm.
The double-sided nature of that opened the whole story and then they knew what it was. So I do think there was a bit of a kind of linchpin quality to Monroe that made the world make sense. And that's just luck and that's just story. And I was lucky to be the one who got to play that. But there was a glue element in the deep workings of the structure of the whole thing, that the thing that the main character is hunting, but who's a different kind of thing, that really fed into, I think, what made Monroe seem sort of special, if we're going to say he was special.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't have worked, honestly. It would have been just a procedural, you know? And I think the grimness that we always talk about, the character of Monroe, like you said, was a major linchpin for that.
Because Monroe is also the axis of everything for me, because he's the guy who's been there before. And even though he's seeing this stuff in a new way, like the Nick character is sort of the Alice watching things happen.
Right.
And that you are the white rabbit who speaks.
Totally.
Oh, that's good, Claire.
That's a great analogy.
Like what Bree's saying and what's awesome to watch in these early episodes too, is your sure-handedness with who this character was immediately. And maybe it didn't feel like that to you, but it comes across so sure and so confident and so specific. It's not this flimsy sort of comic relief thing. Like everything is so serious and intentional and hilarious. Like there's such a weight to it, even though some of the situations can be zany, I guess.
Right. To say the least. Yeah. Claire, I think you're dead on about the voice. And I think this episode, what I actually remember from doing it was the ad-libs that I put in that totally worked, that I did not know they were going to work when I was doing them. And I was outside my comfort zone when I was doing them. And then I saw the episode and I was like, that totally played.
Oh my God. Okay.
One of them was...
Wait, let me guess.
Okay.
Let me guess. Because I actually had this exact thought watching it, because obviously I worked with you forever on it. And the most fun working with you is you're always present and in the moment and loose. But obviously you're an incredible script analysis and you take the words seriously. You're a wordsman, as we all know. But you never felt like trapped in the lines when I would work with you. So I don't remember like a ton of ad-libbing, but this episode, there were several lines I was like, I think he added that. Okay, this is the one I'm going to guess. The half an onion ring?
Oh, totally. Totally. He gives me the money and I'm like, what? That's like a beer and half an onion ring. I don't even honestly know where that came from.
That's so good.
But it worked. And then the other one was, I was going to buy him a drink, I think. When I come out after I have the moment where I'm like, I feel like that might have been an ad lib too. But that one makes more sense. So I'm more thinking like maybe that was written, but I can't remember now.
Just the priceless moment of you landing on your hand when you look at and do that. Just, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, that was a fun episode. I also felt very comfortable because I know Patrick, the guy who was playing the goat man.
Oh, yeah. How do you know him?
I've done theater with him from back in the way day. He was in this company and I did a production of Twelfth Night. And then we just sort of saw each other around. We stayed in touch. You know, Patrick's Roadhouse is him. That place on...
Oh, on PCH.
On PCH. I don't know if he was named after it or it was named after him, but I think that's his family's place. Yeah, he's great. He's all over the place.
I would think that you guys would run into each other on the circuit quite a bit.
Yeah, we totally would.
Now, I have a question because this was, I felt like, the slow pan that launched 10,000 fangirls to fall in love with you, but the slow pan on the cello.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wanted to get some like porn music behind it because that was just like, coming up low, coming up slow, coming up, 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 up the butt, to the face, to the face.
Please don't hear real specific romantic proclivities for stringed instruments.
Yeah.
You look pretty good on that. Did you spend some time learning? Was that real fakey fake?
That was really Fakerson's. But I did get to go see Brahms' double cello concerto for free and had really good seats at the Schnitz, which is saying something because the sound there isn't the best. And that's because the guy who trained me in how to fake it was an actual cellist.
Was he at Oregon Symphony?
Yeah, Oregon Symphony, Portland Symphony. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I watched that scene and I was like, that scene felt canned to me.
Although your reaction when the door knocks, oh my gosh, I think I've seen that look on your face like 65,000 times. That was too good.
No, the truth hurts.
How did you feel moving to Portland, relocating?
I remember the first time when I landed in Portland and we were picked up by Jackson Rau at the airport. We got into the van and we were driving along like 84 or whatever it is into town. I think this was to do the pilot. No, maybe it was to start shooting because it was the summer. I can't remember. But first of all, it was very funny because Jackson was like, look at the blackberries. And someone thought he was talking about the device. And he was talking about the fruit on the side of the road because it was like blackberry season and there are so many blackberries in there. They just grow like oleander grows in LA. There's like blackberries everywhere in the summer. And I remember being like, okay, that's a reality check. Here we are. We got LA coming up, meeting Portland. Portland's talking about actual blackberries. And LA is like, oh, can I see your device? You know? And I remember thinking I was home. I really felt like I was home because I have this New England connection in my life, like a deep New England vibe. And I got to Portland and I was like, oh my gosh, this is New England West. It's the same deal. So I felt immediately at home. So relocating was like coming home, going to Portland.
And you hadn't been there before?
Never once in my life.
At this point, like when you were up for the pilot, did they tell you what Monroe's kind of arc was going to be? Because it felt like they really started writing for you and kind of your interests early. I mean, as we were saying, it was kind of a melding of person and character.
They did not tell me. All I remember is shooting the pilot. I was basically shitting bricks.
Why?
Because I hadn't worked in so long.
What was the last big job? Prison Break? Or
so my last job was, I don't know, man. But it had been a long time since I'd been on a set. I hadn't shot what felt like a big network pilot in a really long time. The last pilot I had done was this thing for ABC Family that didn't go. And it just didn't feel as big. It just felt more small time. That one day on the pilot when I confront Nick and I jump out the window and he comes into the house and I say, let's have a beer. That day I was on set for, you know, 13 hours. And it was the biggest day of my career to that point. Because even on Prison Break, I was just so much part of the ensemble that even though, you know, I had my own storyline and it was a critical storyline and all that business, it just never felt like mano a mano with me and the main guy. Even though, look, I was Wentworth's cellmate, but it was never about me. And this was a day where it was like about me and him. And I was really nervous. And when it was all over, I was like, well, that was fun. Thanks for playing.
So Eeyore.
It's so Eeyore. It's so
Oh my God. But with David, being that what you're describing is the realization of how important that relationship is for the show.
Yeah. And
it's a critical part of the show.
There is so much pressure though, because you know, especially how we all were when we got that job. Like we knew if this doesn't work out, I'm getting fired. Like, of course. And so everybody's right. So nice and complimentary, but it all means jack shit because they're going to send it to people and what people are going to watch it and networks are going to decide. And yeah, they don't like your hair part. And so you're gone. And it is a lot to mentally hurdle over.
Yeah. And I was not accustomed to that shit at all at that time. To me, I was like out of my depth is what it felt like.
I just worked for the first time in over a year and I was so nervous the first day where it was like, I'm 42 years old. I've done a jillion episodes of television right now. And I feel like I can't eat. I'm nauseous. Yeah, it's so hard. Yeah.
I don't know how to do this anymore, basically. Yeah. But you know, the nice thing about being really old and crusty as I am, Claire, you just dropped that 42 in there. I'm not going to tell you where I am on the scale. Being really old and crusty is you just don't really give a shit at the same time. You know what I mean? Like there's a nice level of like, maybe I don't know how to do this anymore, but I also don't really give a shit what you think of me, you know, which like 10 years ago or however long ago, 11 years ago, I was looking at my face. I was like, my God, look at all the gray hair. Yeah. You know, that was 11 years ago. I really did give a shit what people thought of me. And that's just nice to unload that.
Yeah, that's the best part of aging.
Yeah, it's definitely up there.
Aging gracefully.
The cast of Grimm. When I was rewatching it this morning, I took a snap of Sasha. I texted him.
Oh, that was back when they still were graying his hair.
You know what? I think they stopped on this episode.
Yeah. I remember I think we talked about this before, but where Sasha's character, they like just did not know. And poor like Sasha, Canadian good sport, was sort of like, sure, sure, we can do it with, we'll try with the British.
Maybe that's why this episode rang so exciting for his character for me. I actually think I really knew what was going on. Or maybe he knew what was going on.
Although the whole thing of like the Grim Reapers, that was a dead end.
Yeah. And it was almost like, was it just too much? Almost like the Grim Reaper, like too literal, too.
We are the Reaper of the Grim. And they come in with scythes to like chop the Grimm's heads off. I mean, it sounds great on paper, but it was a dead end. I remember there was an episode where I got the crap beaten out of me at a clock tower by these guys. This was back when sometimes they still did the morphing with like masks. So these poor guys were like wearing masks all day on set and they were like beating me up. Because eventually they just went full digital for everybody all the time.
Yeah.
I remember my stunt person had to wear the mask. It was for a long time.
It went pretty far for some of the guys who were the stunt doubles, but then eventually they just dotted everybody.
That stunt guy at the end of this episode definitely had a mask on. I'm grateful I didn't have to do that. I don't know if I could do the show. I'm so claustrophobic.
Oh, God. Yeah, no. Speaking of claustrophobia, I remember when they were fitting me for the mask for Monroe, for the morphing, and they were doing stuff on the cheap, and they were just finding people to, like, do stuff. And I was to go into the valley and have a cast made of my head.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. No.
With some guy who, who is this? I don't know. Go to this address.
Oh, God.
So I drive into the valley and then I turn into an alley in the valley. And it's like one of these small shops with just a garage door opener. And then inside the garage door is all of this paraphernalia of like ghoulishness. And a chair, like a dentist's chair, in the middle of a garage space in the valley where I've been told by a third party to show up to have my head covered in plaster.
Mm-mm. No.
For 20 to 30 minutes.
No.
Breathing through straws. I've never met this person.
That's a hard pass.
And he's kind of like one of these guys. He's like mid-late 20s, maybe early 30s, wearing black. He's clearly sort of hung over. I got messed up eyeliner. And there's one woman with him who's kind of like in his field. And I'm just like, okay. So I sit in this chair and they just start glopping heavy plaster on my head. Mm-mm. And it's like a bell jar, you know, whatever you call those things, like a diving bell heavy. And suddenly I start thinking like I am completely vulnerable. And I start basically panicking.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I envisioned myself going for a walk with my dog in as much detail as I could possibly muster, like every single step. And then that got me through it. But there was a moment where I almost pulled like a Jim Carrey in The Grinch and just kind of got out of the chair and ripped it off my head and drove away.
I actually did have this experience once, and that is what I did. And I was recast.
But that must happen to 4 out of 5 people. Or is there any sort of like, hey, we're going to do this thing? That's what I don't understand. Like, we're going to do this thing. You're going to be very uncomfortable. Raise one finger if you're going to puke.
Yeah, they did that kind of thing. They were like, if you need to tap out, you know,
Boy. Yeah. I'm glad you didn't have to do that again.
No. They gave up on that. They tried so much before they realized it just has to be all CGI. They got two CGI companies, and the dots were the answer.
I mean, 11 years ago is a lifetime in effects world. Yeah. You know, they were really experimenting with a lot.
Yeah. You know, they tried a thing where they had me do like, they had me do like, like all these different faces so that then they could just sort of like use that.
Yeah.
Like,
you're kind of in a light box and then they have the camera that goes, you know, all the way.
Yes, oh, exactly. Yeah. That was like Gary's light box.
Yeah. And making all the faces.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was a good time. So Silas Monroe very quickly became such a fan favorite and you resonated with so many people. Like, what has been your experience when you're at the cons or, you know, just fan interaction in general?
I definitely got a lot of "you're my favorite character" from people, you know, but that's because I think, like you said, there was a feeling from the beginning because, you know, when you're shooting a pilot in the first few episodes, man, you are figuring it out. It's just amazing to go back, just like we were talking about with the CGI. It's amazing to go back and look at how tentative some of this stuff is, you know, and how people are like really feeling their way into it. And there was something about the Monroe voice. It was like Athena out of Zeus's brain, or like I was born whole. You know what I mean? And there was something about that that I can't credit that. It's not me. The idea of the role.
I would say yes. And
well, of course, I mean, of course, I'm the one saying the words, but
energy of like person and character.
Yes, person and yes. Character on top of the fact.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go real base, because we were with you at every convention, and the ladies love the Monroe. The ladies love the Monroe.
I was next to Silas at Dragon Con, and you know, it's so demoralizing, because every actor is there with their own table, and people line up, and I just had, you know, one person every 27 come. And
sitting there without a line in front of your table, man, is just the worst.
I've never felt worse in my entire life, middle school included. It was so bad.
Yeah.
But Silas, who was just like line of people around the block. And finally, I think you were like, I need to go grab a sandwich. Like, I just need to take a break. But there was like no end in sight for this line that was wrapped around.
I mean, you're not on social media. Probably 75% of my direct messages from fans are like, how can I get a hold of Silas? Or like, why isn't Silas on social media? Why isn't Silas on Instagram? Like, how can I get a hold? And I'm like, Jesus, okay. Now, I'm going to take this moment. Being your on-screen love interest in this show that we do not meet yet, I had an interesting perspective watching these. I remember after I was cast, you know, well into the first season, knowing that there was going to be a potential storyline between Rosalie and Monroe. That I was like, okay, well, I need to go back and first, I need to watch the show. I need to like understand the show. But I also want to know like, who the hell is this guy that like I'm going to potentially be in this relationship with? And I remember watching them then, but I just was so excited to meet you because like I've been saying, I was so drawn into your character and I was like, oh, we are going to have a lot of fun. And I don't know how you felt meeting me, but I remember when we did finally meet, I'm going to tease this out because this isn't for a while, but the very first moment I met Silas, also at this time, I did not think I was coming back. I thought it was going to be a 4 to 5 episode gig. So I was keeping to myself and like staying pro. You know, this is everyone else's show. I'm just here to guest and play. I remember sitting in the cast chair at the original Spice Shop downtown in Chinatown, where there was like asbestos everywhere. And I was also pregnant, didn't know it. So that's great. And you come in to the green room or the green area, and you had forgotten to take your real-life wedding ring off your finger. Silas comes in, and he notices it, and he's like, fuck! Fuck! Fucking ruined the day! Because that's how committed. You're so serious. And, like, all the work you just put in, you're like, ah! Oh.
I mean, Monroe can't have a fucking wedding band.
Oh my God. And I remember sitting there just taking you in and being like, I love this guy. He is a crazy person. And he's also takes his job seriously. And I take my job seriously. So I was like, oh, we're going to have fun. But I remember watching these episodes in my house in 2012, just going, Monroe.
I would think that would be an interesting position to be in, to be like joining a show and watching it a little bit and being like, I wonder what that person's actually like. And then realizing that he's a maniac.
Well, so to be fair, you know, I've really said this story too many times, but I was cast and on set within 48 hours. So I didn't have too much lead up. So I had to kind of binge quickly.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Silas.
Oh, you guys.
Oh, Silas.
Just the best.
Thanks for coming on.
So much fun to see you in your little boxes. I love you both.
Love you.
See you later.
Take care, you two. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. There's never a time that I'm hanging out with Silas that I don't learn fascinating data about things that I never cared about before. So,
you know, now I can speak freely since he's not here and I don't want to embarrass him, but getting to know him over the years, he's just like such a sweetheart. I mean, obviously you see that through the Monroe, but he is a really thoughtful person.
He's so thoughtful and he's so genuinely interested in you and people.
So genuinely interested. It's infectious. I mean, my cold heart has been softened. I'm going like a mile a minute, you know, Claire, you and I, we multitask with the best of them.
Yeah.
And he definitely, every time I see him, is like the present moment. And at first, sometimes I'm like, oh my God, I cannot be in the present moment right now. I've got to do 10 things at once. But then it's a really, really lovely quality. I mean, that's what's so fun about now being friends for so long and being together for so many chapters of our own personal lives. Like, we're all growing as like humans, you know, and that's really cool. So Silas is definitely on the journey of being a human, which is my favorite part about him. But I'm glad he jumped on with us chickens.
Yes, you have not seen the last of Silas.
We're glad that you joined us today for this very creepy, really awful, disturbing episode that I'm sure will live on in your nightmares tonight. So you're welcome.
And you can please subscribe to the podcast at apple.co/grimcast so you don't miss an episode.
To be continued.